he said today for the 20th or 30th time. Lauren's a girl, and you let her go. You always let her do things. I could learn to help you guard and scare off robbers. He had once made the mistake of offering to help shoot robbers instead of scaring them off, and Dad all but preached him a sermon. Dad almost never hits us, but he can be scary without lifting a finger. Keith didn't go today, of course. And our practice went all right until we found the corpse. We didn't see any dogs this time. Most upsetting to me, though, there were a few more rag, stick, cardboard, and palm frond shacks along the way into the hills along River Street. There always seemed to be more. They've never bothered us, beyond begging and cursing, but they always stare so. It gets harder to ride past them. They're living skeletons, some of them. Skin and bones and a few teeth. They eat whatever they can find up there. Sometimes I dream about the way they stare at us. Back at home, my brother Keith slipped out of the neighborhood, out through the front gates and away. He stole Corey's key and took off on his own. Dad and I didn't know until we got home. Keith was still gone, and by then, Corey knew he must be outside. She had checked with others in the neighborhood, and two of the Dunn kids, twins Allison and Marie, age 6, said they saw him go out the gate. That was when Corey went home and discovered that her key was gone. Dad, tired and angry and scared, was going to go right back out to look for him, but Keith got home, just as Dad was leaving. Corey, Marcus, and I had gone to the front porch with Dad, all three of us speculating about where Keith had gone, and Marcus and I volunteering to go out with Dad to help search. It was almost dark. "You get back in that house and stay there," Dad said. "It's bad enough to have one of you out there." He checked the submachine gun, made sure it was fully loaded. "Dad, look," I said. I had spotted something moving 3 houses down. Quick, shadowy movement alongside the Garfield porch. I didn't know it was Keith. I was attracted by its furtiveness. Someone was sneaking around, trying to hide. Dad was quick enough to see the movement before it was hidden by the Garfield house. He got up at once, took the gun, and went to check. The rest of us watched and waited. Moments later, Corey said she heard an odd noise in the house. I was too focused on Dad and what was going on outside to hear what she heard, or to pay any attention to her. She went in. Marcus and I were still on the porch when she screamed. Marcus and I glanced at each other, then at the front door. Marcus lunged for the door. I yelled for Dad. Dad was out of sight, but I heard him answer my call. "Come quick," I shouted. Then I ran into the house. Corey, Marcus, Bennett, and Gregory were in the kitchen, clustered around Keith. Keith was sprawled, panting on the floor, wearing only his underpants. He was scraped and bruised, bleeding and filthy. Corey knelt beside him, examining him, questioning him, crying, "What happened to you? Who did this? Why did you go outside? Where are your clothes? What?" "Where's the key you stole?" Dad cut in. "Did they take it from you?" Everyone jumped, looked up at Dad, then down at Keith.
"I couldn't help it," Keith said, still panting. "I couldn't, Daddy. There were 5 guys."
"So they got the key." Keith nodded, careful not to meet Dad's eyes. Dad turned and strode out of the house, almost at a run. It was too late now to get George or Brian Sue to change the gate lock. That would have to be done tomorrow, and new keys made and passed out. I thought Dad might be going out to warn people and to put more watches on duty. I wanted to offer to help alert people, but I didn't. Dad looked too angry to accept help from one of his kids right then. And when he got back, Keith was in for it. Was he ever in for it?
a pair of pants gone, and a shirt and a pair of shoes. Corey had never been willing to let us run around barefoot the way a lot of kids did, except in the house. Her definition of being civilized did not involve dirty, heavily calloused feet, any more than they involved dirty, diseased skin. Shoes were expensive, and we were always growing out of ours, but Corey insisted. Each of us had at least one pair of wearable shoes, in spite of what they cost, and they cost a lot. Now money would have to be found to get an extra pair for Keith. Keith curled up on the floor, smudging the tile with blood from his nose and mouth, hugging himself and crying now that Dad was gone. It took Corey 2 or 3 minutes to get him up and half carry him to the bathroom. I tried to help her, but she stared at me like I was the one who beat him up, so I let them alone. It wasn't as though I wanted to help. I just thought I should. Keith was in real pain, and it was hard for me to endure sharing it. I cleaned up the blood so no one would slip in it or track it around. Then I fixed dinner, ate, fed the 3 younger boys, and put the rest aside for Dad, Corey, and Keith. Sunday, August 3rd, 2025. Keith had to confess what he had done this morning at church. He had to stand up in front of the whole congregation and tell them everything, including what the 5 thugs had done to him. Then he had to apologize to God, to his parents, and to the congregation that he had endangered and inconvenienced. Dad made him do that over Corey's objections. Dad never hit him, though last night he must have been tempted. "Why would you do such a thing?" he kept demanding. "How could any son of mine be so stupid? Where are your brains, boy? What did you think you were doing? I'm talking to you. Answer me." Keith answered and answered and answered, but the answers never seemed to make much sense to Dad. "I ain't no baby no more," he wept, or, "I wanted to show you, just wanted to show you. You always let Lauren do stuff," or, "I'm a man. I shouldn't be hiding in the house, hiding in the wall. I'm a man." It went on and on because Keith refused to admit he had done anything wrong. He wanted to show he was a man, not a scared girl. It wasn't his fault that a gang of guys jumped him, beat him, robbed him. He didn't do anything. It wasn't his fault. Dad stared at him in utter disgust. "You disobeyed," he said. "You stole. You endangered the lives and the property of everyone here, including your mother, your sister, and your little brothers. If you were the man you think you are, I'd beat the hell out of you." Keith stared straight ahead. "Bad guys come in even if they don't have a key," he muttered. "They come in and steal stuff. It's not my fault." It took Dad 2 hours to get Keith to admit that it was his fault. No excuses. He'd done wrong. He wouldn't do it again. My brother isn't very smart, but he makes up for it in pure stubbornness. My father is smart and stubborn. Keith didn't have a chance, but he made Dad work for his victory. The next morning, Dad had his revenge. I don't believe he thought of Keith's forced confession that way, but Keith's expression told me that he did. "How do I get out of this family?" Marcus muttered to me as we watched. I sympathized. He had to share a room with Keith, and the 2 of them, only 1 year apart in age, fought all the time. Now things would be worse. Keith is Corey's favorite. If you asked her, she would say she didn't have a favorite, but she does. She babies him and lets him get away with skipping chores, a little lying, a little stealing. Maybe that's why Keith thinks when he screws up, it's okay. This morning's sermon was on the 10 Commandments, with extra emphasis on honor thy father and thy mother
and thou shalt not steal. I think Dad got rid of a lot of anger and frustration preaching that sermon. Keith, tall, stone-faced, looking older than his 13 years, kept his anger. I could see him keeping it inside, holding it down, choking on it. Chapter 9. All struggles are essentially power struggles. Who will rule? Who will lead? Who will define, refine, confine, design? Who will dominate? All struggles are essentially power struggles. And most are no more intellectual than two rams knocking their heads together. Earthseed, The Books of the Living. Sunday, August 17th, 2025. My parents' usual good judgment failed them this week on my brother Keith's birthday. They gave him his own BB gun. It wasn't new, but it worked. And it looked much more dangerous than it was. And it was his. He didn't have to share it. I suppose it was intended to make him feel better about the 2 years he still had to wait until he got his hands on the Smith & Wesson, or better yet, the Heckler & Koch. And of course, it was supposed to help him get over his stupid desire to sneak out, and the humiliation of his public confession. Keith shot a few more pigeons and crows, threatened to shoot Marcus. Marcus just told me about that tonight. Then yesterday, he took off for parts unknown. He took the BB gun with him, of course. No one has seen him for about 18 hours, and there's not much doubt that he's gone outside again. Monday, August 18th, 2025. Dad went out looking for Keith today. He even called in the police. He says he doesn't know how we'll afford the fee, but he's scared. The longer Keith is gone, the more likely he is to get hurt or killed. Marcus says he thinks Keith went looking for the guys who beat him up. I don't believe it. Not even Keith would go looking for 5 guys, or even 1 guy, with nothing but a BB gun. Corey's even more upset than Dad. She's scared and jumpy and sick to her stomach, and she keeps crying. I talked her into going back to bed, then taught her classes myself. I've done that 4 or 5 times before when she was sick, so it wasn't too weird for the kids. I just used Corey's lesson plans. And during the first part of the day, I partnered the older kids with my kindergartners and let everyone get a taste of teaching or learning from someone different. Some of my students are my age and older, and a couple of these, Aura Moss and Michael Talcott, got up and left. They knew I understood the work. I got the last of my high school work and tests out of the way almost 2 years ago. Since then, I've done uncredited, free college work with Dad. Michael and Aura know all that, but they're much too grown up to learn anything from the likes of me. The hell with them. It's a pity, though, that my Curtis has to have a brother like Michael. Not that any of us gets to choose our brothers. Tuesday, August 19th, 2025. No sign of Keith. I think Corey has gone into mourning for him. I handled classes again today, and Dad went out searching again. He came home looking exhausted tonight, and Corey wept and shouted at him. "You didn't try," she said, with me and all 3 of my brothers looking on. We'd all come to see whether Dad had brought Keith back. "You could have found him if you'd tried." Dad tried to go to her, but she backed away, still shouting, "If it were your precious Lauren out there alone, you would have found her by now. You don't care about Keith." She's never said anything like that before. I mean, we were always Corey and Lauren. She never asked me to call her mother, and I never thought to do it. I always knew she was my stepmother, but still,
I always loved her. It mystified me that Keith was her favorite, but it didn't make me love her any less. I was her kid. But not her kid. Not quite. Not really. But I always thought she loved me. Dad shooed us all off to bed. He quieted Corey and took her back to their room. A few minutes ago, he came to see me. "She didn't mean it," he said. "She loves you as though you were her daughter, Lauren." I just looked at him. "She wants you to know she's sorry." I nodded, and after a few more assurances, he went. "Is she sorry?" "I don't think so." "Did she mean it?" "She did. Oh, yes, she meant it." "Shit." Thursday, August 30th, 2025. Keith came back last night. He just walked into the house during dinner, as though he'd been outside playing football instead of gone since Saturday. And this time, he looked fine. Not a mark on him. He was wearing a clean new set of clothing. Even new shoes. All of it was of much better quality than he had when he left, and much more expensive than we could have afforded. He still had the BB gun until Dad took it away from him and smashed it. Keith wouldn't say where he'd been or how he'd gotten the new things, so Dad beat him bloody. I've only seen Dad like that once before, when I was 12. Corey tried to stop him, tried to pull him off Keith, screamed at him in English, then in Spanish, then without words. Gregory threw up on the floor, and Bennett started to cry. Marcus backed away from the whole scene and slipped out of the house. Then it was over. Keith was crying like a 2-year-old, and Corey was holding him. Dad stood over both of them, looking dazed. I followed Marcus out the back door and stumbled and almost fell down the back steps. I didn't know what I was doing. Marcus wasn't around. I sat on the steps in the warm darkness and let my body shake and hurt and vomit in helpless empathy with Keith. Then I guess I passed out. I came to sometime later with Marcus shaking me and whispering my name. I got up with Marcus hanging onto my arm, trying to steady me, and I got to my bedroom. "Let me sleep in here," he whispered once I was sitting on my bed, dazed and still in pain. "I'll sleep on the floor, I don't care." "All right," I said, not caring where he slept. I lay down on the bed without taking off even my shoes, and drew my body into a fetal ball on top of the bedclothes. I either fell asleep that way or I passed out again. Saturday, October 25th, 2025. Keith has gone outside again. He went yesterday afternoon. Corey didn't admit until tonight that he took not only her key this time, but her gun. He took the Smith & Wesson. Dad refused to go out and look for him. Dad slept in his office last night. He's sleeping there again tonight. I never liked my brother much. I hate him now, for what he's doing to the family, for what he's doing to my father. I hate him. Damn, I hate him. Monday, November 3rd, 2025. Keith came home tonight, while Dad was visiting over at the Talcott house. I suspect that Keith hung around and watched the house and waited until Dad left. He had come to see Corey. He brought her a lot of money, done up in a fat roll. She stared at it, then took it, dazed. "So much, Keith," she whispered. "Where did you get it?" "It's for you," he said. "All for you, not him." He took her hand and closed it around the money, and she let him do it, though she had to know it must be stolen money or drug money or worse. Keith gave Bennett and Gregory big, expensive bars of milk chocolate with peanuts. He just smiled at Marcus and me, an obvious fuck-you smile. Then, before Dad could come home and find him here, he left again. Corey hadn't realized that he was leaving again, and she all but screamed and clung to him. No! You'll be killed out there. What's the matter with you? Stay home. Mama, I won't let him beat me again, he said. I don't need him hitting me and telling me what to do. Pretty soon, I'll be able to make more money in a day than he can in a week. Maybe in a month. You'll be killed. No, I won't. I know what I'm doing. He kissed her. Then, with surprising ease, took her arms from around him. I'll come back and see you, he said. I'll bring you presents. And he vanished out the back door and was gone. 2026. Civilization is to groups what intelligence is to individuals. It is a means of combining the intelligence of many to achieve ongoing group adaptation. Civilization, like intelligence, may serve well, serve adequately, or fail to serve its adaptive function. When civilization fails to serve, it must disintegrate, unless it is acted upon by unifying internal or external forces. Earthseed, The Books of the Living. Chapter 10. When apparent stability disintegrates, as it must, God is change, people tend to give in to fear and depression, to need and greed. When no influence is strong enough to unify people, they divide, they struggle, one against one, group against group, for survival, position, power. They remember old hates and generate new ones. They create chaos and nurture it. They kill and kill and kill until they are exhausted and destroyed, until they are conquered by outside forces, or until one of them becomes a leader most will follow, or a tyrant most fear. Earthseed, The Books of the Living. Thursday, June 25th, 2026. Keith came home yesterday, bigger than ever, as tall and lean as Dad is tall and broad. He's not quite 14, but he already looks like the man he wants so much to be. We're like that, we Olaminas. Tall, sturdy, fast-growing people. Except for Gregory, who was only 9, we all tower over Corey. I'm still the tallest, but my height seems to annoy her these days. She loves Keith's size, though, her big son. She just hates the fact that he doesn't live with us anymore. I got a room, he said to me yesterday. We talked, he and I. Corey was with Dorothea Cruz, who is one of her best friends and who has just had another baby. The other boys were playing in the street and on the island. Dad had gone to the college and would be gone overnight. Now, more than ever, it's safest to go out just at dawn and not try coming home until just at dawn the next morning. That's if you have to go outside at all, which Dad does about once a week. The worst parasites still prowl at night and sleep late into the morning. Yet Keith lives outside. I got a room in a building with some other people, he said. Translation, he and his friends were squatting in an abandoned building. Who were his friends? A gang? A flock of prostitutes? A bunch of astronauts flying high on drugs? A den of thieves? All of the above? Whenever he came to see us, he brought money to Corey and little gifts to Bennett and Gregory. How could he get money? There's no honest way. Do your friends know how old you are?
I asked. He grinned. Hell no. Why should I tell them that? I nodded. It does help to look older sometimes. You want something to eat? You gonna cook for me? I've cooked for you hundreds of times, thousands, I know. But you always had to before. Don't be stupid. You think I couldn't act the way you did, skip out on my responsibilities if I felt like it? I don't feel like it. You want to eat or not? Sure. I made rabbit stew and acorn bread, enough for Corey and all the boys when they came in. He hung around and watched me work for a while, then began to talk to me. He's never done that before. We never, never liked each other, he and I. But he had information I wanted, and he seemed to want to talk. I must have been the safest person he could talk to. He wasn't afraid of shocking me. He didn't much care what I thought. And he wasn't afraid I'd tell Dad or Corey anything he said. Of course, I wouldn't. Why cause them pain? I'd never been much for tattling on people anyway. It's just a nasty old building on the outside, he was saying of his new home. You wouldn't believe how great it looks once you go in, though. Whorehouse or spaceship? I asked. It's got stuff like you never saw, he evaded. TV windows you go through instead of just sitting and looking at. Headsets, belts, and touch rings. You see and feel everything, do anything, anything. There's places and things you can get into with that equipment that are insane. You don't ever have to go into the street except to get food. And whoever owns this stuff took you in? I asked. Yeah. Why? He looked at me for a long time, then started to laugh. Because I can read and write, he said at last, and none of them can. They're all older than me, but not one of them can read or write anything. They stole all this great stuff and they couldn't even use it. Before I got there, they even broke some of it because they couldn't read the instructions. Corey and I had had a hell of a struggle teaching him to read and write. He had been bored, impatient, anything but eager. So, you read for a living. Help your new friends learn to use their stolen equipment, I said. Yeah. And what else? Nothing else. What a piss-poor liar he is, always was. He's got no conscience. He just isn't smart enough to tell convincing lies. Drugs, Keith? I asked him. Prostitution? Robbery? I said nothing else. You always think you know everything. I sighed. You're not done causing Dad and Corey pain, are you? Not by a long shot. He looked as though he wanted to shout back at me or hit me. He might have done one or the other if I hadn't mentioned Corey. I don't give a shit about him, he said, his voice low and ugly. He had a man's voice already. He had everything but a man's brain. I do more for her than he does. I bring her money and nice things. And my friends know she lives here. And they let this place alone. He's nothing. I turned and looked at him. And saw my father's face, lighter skinned, younger, thinner, but my father's face, unmistakable. He's you, I whispered. Every time I look at you, I see him. Every time you look at him, you see yourself. Dog shit. I shrugged. It was a long time before he spoke again. At last he said, Did he ever hit you? Not for about 5 years. Why'd he hit you? Back then. I thought about that and decided to tell him. He was old enough. He caught me and Reuben Quintanilla in the bushes together. Keith shouted with abrupt laughter. You and Reuben? Really? You were doing it with him? You're kidding.
We were 12. What the hell? You're lucky you didn't get pregnant. I know. 12 can be a dumb age. He looked away. Bet he didn't beat you as bad as he beat me. He sent you boys over to play with the Talcotts. I gave him a glass of cold orange juice and poured one for myself. I don't remember, he said. You were 9, I said. Nobody was going to tell you what was going on. As I remember, I told you I fell down the back steps. He frowned, perhaps remembering. My face had been memorable. Dad hadn't beat me as badly as he beat Keith, but I looked worse. He should remember that. He ever beat up Mama? I shook my head. No, I've never seen any sign of it. I don't think he would. He loves her, you know. He really does. Bastard. He's our father, and he's the best man I know. Did you think that when he beat you? No. But later when I figured out how stupid I'd been, I was just glad he was so strict. And back when it happened, I was just glad he didn't quite kill me. He laughed again, twice, in just a few minutes, and both times at things I'd said. Maybe he was ready to open up a little now. Tell me about the outside, I said. How do you live out there? He drained the last of his second glass of juice. I told you, I live real good out there. But how did you live when you first went out? When you went to stay? He looked at me and smiled. He smiled like that years ago, when he used red ink to trick me into bleeding in empathy with a wound he didn't have. I remember that particular nasty smile. You want to go out yourself, don't you? He demanded. Someday? What? Instead of marrying Curtis and having a bunch of babies? Yeah. Instead of that. I wondered why you were being so nice to me. The food smelled just about ready, so I got up and took the bread from the oven and bowls from the cupboard. I was tempted to let him dish up his own stew, but I knew he would spoon all the meat out of the stew and leave nothing but potatoes and vegetables for the rest of us, so I served him and myself, covered the pot, left it on the lowest possible fire, and put a towel over the bread. I let him eat in peace for a while, though I thought the boys would be coming at any time now, starving. Then I was afraid to wait any longer. Talk to me, Keith, I said. I really want to know. How did you survive when you first went out there? His smile this time was less evil. Maybe the food had mellowed him. Slept in a cardboard box for 3 days and stole food, he said. I don't know why I kept going back to that box. Could have slept in any old corner. Some kids carry a piece of cardboard to sleep on, so they won't be right down on the ground, you know. Then I got a sleep sack from an old man. It was new, like he never used it. You stole it? He gave me a look of scorn. What do you think I was going to do? I didn't have no money. Just had the gun. Mama's 38. Yes. He had brought it back to her 3 visits ago, along with 2 boxes of ammunition. Of course, he never said how he got the ammunition or how he got his replacement gun, a Heckler and Koch 9mm just like Dad's. He just showed up with things and claimed that if you had the money, you could buy anything outside. He had never admitted how he got the money. Okay, I said. So you stole a sleep sack. And you kept stealing food? It's a wonder you didn't get caught. The old guy had some money. I used it to buy food. Then I started walking toward L.A. That old dream of his. For reasons that make sense to him alone, he always wanted to go to L.A. Any sane person would be thankful for the 20 miles that separate us from that oozing sore. There's people all over the freeway, coming away from L.A., he said. There's even people walking up from way down in San Diego. They don't know where they're going. I talked to this guy. He said he was going to Alaska. God damn, Alaska! Good luck to him, I said. He's got a lot of guns to face before he gets there. He won't get there. Alaska must be 1,000 miles from here. I nodded. More than that. And with hostile state lines and borders along the way. But good luck to him anyhow. It's a goal that makes sense. He had $23,000 in his pack. I didn't say anything. I just froze, stared at him in disgust and renewed dislike. But of course, of course. You wanted to know, he said. That's what it's like outside. If you got a gun, you're somebody. If you don't, you're shit. And a lot of people out there don't have guns. I thought most of them did. Except the ones too poor to be worth robbing. I thought so, too. But guns cost a lot. And it's easier to get one if you already got one, you know? What if that Alaska guy had had one? You'd be dead. I sneaked up on him while he was sleeping, just sort of followed him until he went off the road to go to sleep. Then I got him. He led me away from L.A., though. You shot him? The nasty smile again. He talked to you. He was friendly to you, and you shot him. What was I supposed to do? Wait for God to come and give me some money? What was I supposed to do? Come home. Shit. Doesn't it even bother you that you took someone's life? You killed a man? He seemed to think about that for a while. Then he shook his head. It don't bother me, he said. I was scared at first, but then, after I did it, I didn't feel nothing. Nobody saw me do it. I just took his stuff and left him there. Besides, maybe he wasn't dead. People don't always die just because you shoot them. You didn't check? I just wanted his stuff. He was crazy anyway, Alaska. I didn't say any more to him. Didn't ask any more questions. He talked a little about meeting some guys and joining up with them, then discovering that even though they were all older than he was, none of them could read or write. He was a help to them. He made their lives pleasanter. Maybe that's why they didn't just wait until he was asleep and kill him and take his loot for themselves. After a while, he noticed that I wasn't saying anything, and he laughed. You better marry Curtis and make babies, he said. Out there, outside, you wouldn't last a day. That hyper-empathy shit of yours would bring you down even if nobody touched you. You think that? I said. Hey. I saw a guy get both of his eyes gouged out. After that, they set him on fire and watched him run around and scream and burn. You think you could stand to see that? Your new friends did that? I asked. Hell no. Crazies did that. Paints. They shave off all their hair, even their eyebrows. And they paint their skin green or blue or red or yellow. They eat fire and kill rich people. They do what? They take that drug that makes them like to watch fires. Sometimes a campfire or a trash fire or a house fire. Or sometimes they grab a rich guy and set him on fire. Why? I don't know. They're crazy. I heard some of them used to be rich kids, so I don't know why they hate rich people so much. That drug is bad, though. Sometimes the paints like the fire so much, they get too close to it. Then their friends don't even help them. They just watch them burn. It's like, I don't know. It's like they were fucking the fire. It's like it was the best fuck they ever had. You've never tried it? Hell no, I told you, those guys are crazy. You know, even the girls shave their heads. Damn, they look ugly. They're mostly kids, then. Yeah. Your age up to maybe 20.
There's a few old ones, 25, even 30. I hear most of them don't live that long, though. Corey and the boys came in at that moment. Gregory and Bennett excited because their side in soccer had won. Corey was happy and wistful, talking to Marcus about Dorothea Cruz's new baby girl. Things changed when they all saw Keith, of course, but the evening wasn't too bad. Keith had presents for the little boys, of course, and money for Corey, and nothing for Marcus and me. This time, though, he was a little shamefaced with me. "Maybe I'll bring you something next time," he said. "No, don't," I said, thinking of the Alaska-bound traveler. "It's all right. I don't want anything." He shrugged and turned to talk to Corey. Monday, July 20th, 2026. Keith came to see me today just before dark. He found me walking home from the Talcott house, where Curtis had been wishing me a very happy birthday. "We've been very careful, Curtis and I, but from somewhere or other, he's gotten a supply of condoms. They're old-fashioned, but they work. And there is an unused dark room in a corner of the Talcott garage." Keith scared me out of a very sweet mood. He came from behind two houses without making a sound. He had almost reached me before I realized someone was there and turned to face him. He raised his hands, smiling. "Bought you a birthday present," he said. He put something into my left hand. Money. "Keith, no. Give it to Corey. You give it to her. You want her to have it? You give it to her. I give it to you." I walked him to the gate, concerned that one of the watchers might spot him and shoot him. He was that much taller than he had been when he stopped living with us. Dad was home, so he wouldn't come in. I thanked him for the money and told him I would give it to Corey. I wanted him to know that because I didn't want him to bring me anything else, ever. He seemed not to mind. He kissed the side of my face and said, "Happy birthday," and went out. He still had Corey's key, and although Dad knew he had it, he hadn't had the lock changed again. Wednesday, August 26, 2026. Today, my parents had to go downtown to identify the body of my brother Keith. Saturday, August 29th, 2026. I haven't been able to write a word since Wednesday. I don't know what to write. The body was Keith's. I never saw it, of course. Dad said he tried to keep Corey from seeing it. The things someone had done to Keith before he died. I don't want to write about this, but I need to. Sometimes writing about a thing makes it easier to stand. Someone had cut and burned away most of my brother's skin, everywhere except his face. They burned out his eyes, but left the rest of his face intact, like they wanted him to be recognized. They cut and they cauterized, and they cut and they cauterized. Some of the wounds were days old. Someone had an endless hatred of my brother. Dad got us all together and described to us what had been done. He told it in a flat, dead monotone. He wanted to scare us, to scare Marcus, Bennett, and Gregory in particular. He wanted us to understand just how dangerous the outside is. The police said drug dealers torture people the way Keith was tortured. They torture people who steal from them and people who compete with them. We don't know whether Keith was doing either of these things. We just know he's dead. His body was dumped across town from here, in front of a burned-out old building that was once a nursing home. It was dumped on the broken concrete and abandoned several hours after Keith died.
It could have been dumped in one of the canyons, and only the dogs would have found it, but someone wanted it to be found, wanted it to be recognized. Had one of his victim's relatives or friends managed to get even at last? The police seemed to think we should know who killed him. I got the feeling from their questions that they would have been happy to arrest Dad or Corey or both of them. But they both led very public lives, and neither had any unexplained absences or other breaks in routine. Dozens of people could give them alibis. Of course, I'd said nothing about what Keith had told me he'd been doing. What good would that do? He was dead, and in a horrible way. By accident or by intent, all his victims were avenged. Wardell Parrish felt called upon to tell the police about the big fight Dad and Keith had had last year. He'd heard it, of course. Half the neighborhood had heard it. Family fights are neighborhood theater, and Dad the minister, after all. I know Wardell Parrish was the one who told the cops. His youngest niece, Tanya, let that much slip. Uncle Ward said he hated to mention it, but, oh, I'll bet he hated to mention it, damn bastard. But nobody backed him up. The cops went nosing around the neighborhood, but no one else admitted knowing anything about a fight. After all, they knew Dad didn't kill Keith, and they knew the cops liked to solve cases by discovering evidence against whomever they decided must be guilty. Best to give them nothing. They never helped when people called for help. They came later, and more often than not made a bad situation worse. We had the service today. Dad asked his friend, Reverend Robinson, to take care of it. Dad just sat with Corey and the rest of us and looked bent and old. So old. Corey cried all day, most of the time without making a sound. She's been crying off and on since Wednesday. Marcus and Dad tried to comfort her. Even I tried, though the way she looked at me, as though I had had something to do with Keith's death, as though she almost hated me. I keep reaching out to her. I don't know what else to do. Maybe in time she'll be able to forgive me for not being her daughter, for being alive when her son is dead, for being Dad's daughter by someone else. I don't know. Dad never shed a tear. I've never seen him cry in my life. Today, I wish he would. I wish he could. Curtis Talcott sort of hung around with me today, and we talked and talked. I guess I needed to talk, and Curtis was willing to put up with me. He said I should cry. He said no matter how bad things had gotten between Keith and me or Keith and the family, I should let myself cry. Odd. Until he brought it up, I hadn't thought about my own absence of tears. I hadn't cried at all. Maybe Corey had noticed. Maybe my dry face was just one more grudge she held against me. It wasn't that I was holding back, being stoic. It's just that I hated Keith at least as much as I loved him. He was my brother, half-brother, but he was also the most sociopathic person I've ever been close to. He would have been a monster if he had been allowed to grow up. Maybe he was one already. He never cared what he did. If he wanted to do something, and it wouldn't cause him immediate physical pain, he did it. Fuck the earth. He messed up our family, broke it into something less than a family. Still, I would never have wished him dead. I would never wish anyone dead in that horrible way. I think he was killed by monsters much worse than himself. It's beyond me how one human being could do that to another. If hyper-empathy syndrome were a more common complaint, people couldn't do such things. They could kill if they had to, and bear the pain of it, or be destroyed by it. But if everyone could feel everyone else's pain,
Who would torture? Who would cause anyone unnecessary pain? I've never thought of my problem as something that might do some good before, but the way things are, I think it would help. I wish I could give it to people. Failing that, I wish I could find other people who have it and live among them. A biological conscience is better than no conscience at all. But as for me crying, if I were going to cry, I think I would have done it back when Dad beat Keith. When the beating was over and Dad saw what he had done, and when we all saw how both Keith and Corey looked at him, I knew then that neither of them would ever forgive him, not ever. That was the end of something precious in the family. I wish Dad could cry for his son, but I don't feel any need at all to cry for my brother. May he rest in peace, in his urn, in heaven, wherever. Chapter 11. Any change may bear seeds of benefit. Seek them out. Any change may bear seeds of harm. Beware. God is infinitely malleable. God is change. Earthseed, The Books of the Living. Saturday, October 17th, 2026. We are coming apart. The community, the families, individual family members. We're a rope, breaking, a single strand at a time. There was another robbery last night, or an attempted robbery. I wish that was all. No garden theft this time. Three guys came over the wall and crowbarred their way into the Cruz house. The Cruz family, of course, has loud burglar alarms, barred windows, and security gates at all the doors, just like the rest of us. But that doesn't seem to matter. When people want to come in, they come in. The thieves used simple hand tools. Crowbars, hydraulic jacks, things anyone can get. I don't know how they disabled the burglar alarm. I know they cut the electrical and phone lines to the house. That shouldn't have mattered, since the alarm had backup batteries. Whatever else they did or whatever went wrong, the alarm didn't go off. And after the thieves used the crowbar on the door, they walked into the kitchen and used it on Dorothea Cruz's 75-year-old grandmother. The old lady was a light sleeper and had gotten into the habit of getting up at night and brewing herself a cup of lemongrass tea. Her family says that's what she was coming into the kitchen to do when the thieves broke in. Then Dorothea's brothers, Hector and Ruben Quintanilla, came running, guns in hand. They had the bedroom nearest to the kitchen, and they heard all the noise, the break-in itself, and Mrs. Quintanilla being knocked against the kitchen table and chairs. They killed two of the thieves. The third got away, perhaps wounded. There was a lot of blood. But old Mrs. Quintanilla was dead. This is the seventh incident since Keith was killed. More and more people are coming over our wall to take what we have and what they think we have. Seven intrusions into house and garden in less than 2 months, in an 11-household community. If this is what's happening to us, what must it be like for people who are really rich? Although perhaps with their big guns, private armies of security guards, and up-to-date security equipment, they're better able to fight back. Maybe that's why we're getting so much attention. We have a few stealables, and we're not that well protected. Of the seven intrusions, three were successful. Thieves got in and out with something. A couple of radios, a sack of walnuts, wheat flour, cornmeal, pieces of jewelry, an ancient TV, a computer. If they could carry it, they made off with it. If what Keith told me is true, we're getting the poorer class of thieves here. No doubt the tougher, smarter, more courageous thieves hit stores and businesses. But our lower-class thugs are killing us slowly. Next year, I'll be 18, old enough, according to Dad, to stand a regular night watch. I wish I could do it now. As soon as I can do it, I will. But it won't be enough. It's funny. Corey and Dad have been using some of the money Keith brought us to help the people who've been robbed. Stolen money to help victims of theft. Half the money is hidden in our backyard in case of disaster. There has always been some money hidden out there. Now there's enough to make a difference. The other half has gone into the church fund to help our neighbors in emergencies. It won't be enough. Tuesday, October 20th, 2026. Something new is beginning, or perhaps something old and nasty is reviving. A company called Kajimoto Stam Frampton & Company, KSF, has taken over the running of a small coastal city called Olivar. Olivar, incorporated in the 1980s, is just one more beach bedroom suburb of Los Angeles, small and well-to-do. It has little industry, much hilly, vacant land, and a short, crumbling coastline. Its people, like some here in our Robledo neighborhood, earn salaries that would once have made them prosperous and comfortable. In fact, Olivar is a lot richer than we are, but since it's a coastal city, its taxes are higher, and since some of its land is unstable, it has extra problems. Parts of it sometimes crumble into the ocean, undercut or deeply saturated by salt water. Sea level keeps rising with the warming climate, and there is the occasional earthquake. Olivar's flat, sandy beach is already just a memory. So are the houses and businesses that used to sit on that beach. Like coastal cities all over the world, Olivar needs special help. It's an upper-middle-class, white, literate community of people who once had a lot of weight to throw around. Now, not even the politicians it's helped to elect will stand by it. The whole state, the country, the world needs help, it's been told. What the hell is tiny Olivar whining about? Somewhat richer and less geologically active communities are getting help. Dikes, sea walls, evacuation assistance, whatever's appropriate. Olivar, located between the sea and Los Angeles, is getting an influx of salt water from one direction and desperate poor people from the other. It has a solar-powered desalination plant on some of its flatter, more stable land, and that provides its people with a dependable supply of water. But it can't protect itself from the encroaching sea, the crumbling earth, the crumbling economy, or the desperate refugees. Even getting back and forth to work, for those few who can't work at home, was becoming as dangerous for them as it is for our people, a kind of terrible gauntlet that has to be run over and over again. Then the people of KSF showed up. After many promises, much haggling, suspicion, fear, hope, and legal wrangling, the voters and the officials of Olivar permitted their town to be taken over, bought out, privatized. KSF will expand the desalination plant to vast size. That plant will be the first of many. The company intends to dominate farming and the selling of water and solar and wind energy over much of the Southwest, where for pennies, it's already bought vast tracts of fertile, waterless land. So far, Olivar is one of its smaller coastal holdings, but with Olivar, it gets an eager, educated workforce. People a few years older than I am, whose options are very limited. Not as limited as ours, of course, but limited. And there's all that formerly public land that they now control. They mean to own great water, power, and agricultural industries in an area that most people have given up on. They have long-term plans, and the people of Olivar have decided to become part of them, to accept smaller salaries than their socioeconomic group is used to in exchange for security, a guaranteed food supply, jobs, and help in their battle with the Pacific. There are still people in Olivar who are uncomfortable with the change. They know about early American company towns in which the companies cheated and abused people. But this is to be different.
The people of Olivar aren't frightened, impoverished victims. They're able to look after themselves, their rights, and their property. They're educated people who don't want to live in the spreading chaos of the rest of Los Angeles County. Some of them said so on the radio documentary.